Kia ora. Welcome to IOU, the University of Otago Alumni Podcast Series, where we get to talk to some of our extraordinary graduates about their out-of-the-ordinary day jobs. Kia ora. I'd like to welcome Josh Whale, a Law and Arts graduate from Otago, who has taken an interesting path since leaving university. Josh has worked as an intellectual property lawyer for a Chinese firm, and in 2014 set up an e-mobility energy startup called Ampersand in Africa. Ampersand develops cargo electric and solar charged bikes for tough African roads, so not your average day job. So welcome, Josh.
Thanks, it's an honour to be here.
Where are you right now? Where are you talking to us from?
I'm calling in from Nairobi in Kenya.
And is that Ampersand's base?
So we're based actually in Kigali in Rwanda, but we expanded into Kenya about 2 years ago. Nairobi is really also the hub for kind of innovation startups in the venture capital community here. So for a lot of my role, which typically involves fundraising, like most startups, especially these days. Made the move over to Kenya. And Kenya is also home to around 1.5 or 2 million of the types of petrol motorcycles that we are replacing with electric motorcycles.
So I guess we want to know how you got from Otago to e-bikes in Kenya. So the start of your journey, if we take that at Otago, can you tell us why you chose Otago and why you chose to study law and politics and Chinese language?
Yeah, it was quite an eclectic mix. So I started at Otago back in 2000. So dating myself a bit now, and I graduated in 2006. So spent a total of 5 years there. So I originally enrolled in politics and in international business, which was a brand new course at the time. Interdisciplinary within the comms department, within the BCOM department. And part of that requirement was to take a language. And I was fortunate enough to grow up with German as well. So I thought I'd take a risk because I figured I could fall back on the German and take Chinese as well. In the end, I found hanging out with other students who were studying law really excited me, and I felt a closer affinity. So I went ahead and did laws, booked the first year law course and got in as well. But a big reason I chose Otago in the first place, this ability to kind of mix and match between different departments, to do the cross-crediting, to not have to choose a major from day one, and also the appeal of going to a university that really had that whole university town kind of culture and vibe, that full sort of immersive experience rather than a university in a big city where you're more integrated. And then finally, really a love of the outdoors and the natural world more generally, which of course Otago is fantastic for. And joined the tramping club and got the student discount annual passes for Trip Cone and really made the most of that.
And I think I saw that you were in the rowing club as well.
That's right, yeah. So I had rowed in high school, and I joined the rowing team for the first year, but then the rowing got in the way of the tramping and mountaineering, so I ended up switching over. I think that was after two summers I switched over to the tramping team, as it were.
Do you get to do anything like that in Kenya? Do you get to go tramping or anything in the outdoors?
Well, we moved to Kenya only not so long ago, and I have a young son, so we haven't really immersed yet. What we end up doing more is going on safari, so heading out into the bush and hanging out with the animals. There is actually a crew here, including an ex-Otago alum I just learned, who do quite a lot of mountaineering in Kenya. So on Mount Kenya itself, and there's an active rock climbing scene here. But in Rwanda, we got into mountain biking, and then later, because I was running a motorcycle company, it sort of seemed appropriate that I learned to ride a motorcycle. So that ended up being my kind of main form of recreation. Have to be able to eat your own dog food, as they say.
From Otago, I understand you went on an exchange to China. Where did you go from Otago, and was that exchange quite pivotal?
Yeah, I actually did two student exchanges. So one thing that happened during the traveling club is I met my now wife, who is an exchange student from the US. And Claire, we're just coming up on our 20th anniversary since we officially hooked up at a Black Seas concert in the student union building, you know, spates and plastic cups and sticky floors and that sort of thing. But
that's right, as you do.
As you do. Yeah. And so I went on an exchange to UVA in Virginia. And at the time, this was not too long after 9/11. And so the requirements to go, you had to go to an interview in Auckland to get your visa. It meant that not that many students were going, which is a real shame because UVA was a fantastic university as well. But it was also motivated by being as close as I could to where Claire was going to be. Because her exchange had ended. And I also went to Dalian because I'd studied and I actually kept going with the Chinese at Otago, which was brilliant. And at the time, it was the number of students that actually went through into third year and graduation were pretty small. I can't remember exactly, but it was less than 10 students a year. But it was wonderful to be able to actually complete that degree with the strong encouragement of the Chinese department. By doing an exchange semester in Dalian. And back in those days, with your student loan, it was pretty, you couldn't actually support yourself with a student loan. But in contrast, in China back then, this is going back to 2002, you could actually live pretty nicely, especially in not in Beijing or Shanghai, but in one of these secondary cities, you know, sort of beers were about 30 cents and bag of noodles for lunch was about the same. So that was fantastic.
That sounds very nutritious.
Yeah. Not bad. Not bad as compared to some of the, you know, mince. Isn't mince a vegetable, student days?
I'm sure it is. It still is. And so were there any other memorable papers or things that you did at Otago that had an influence on your direction?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I was at Otago for quite a while, and I did take a really broad sampling of different courses and different teaching styles, which was fantastic. But I guess the two that stand out are probably not a surprise for my fellow alums of that generation. It would be Nigel Jameson's legal history in first year law, which was taught in such an iconic style, and Nigel was himself a real institution at Otago for many decades, and also James Flynn's Politics 101. So actually both first year courses, but particularly the Pols 101 was, it was definitely at the level of a more like a third level course. So it was a pretty rude awakening for a fresher back at the time, but fantastically eye-opening, you know, going all the way back to Plato and Socrates, all the way through to the modern philosophers of politics and the political system.
So would you recommend to a lot of students to do a broad base like you did, as well as your law degree, you've got these arts subjects and you've been on exchanges. Did that really add to your degree?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I'd strongly recommend doing the exchange semesters. I think it's great that the way that first year law is set up at Otago is that it is, I mean, it ends up being, and then back then it ended up being more like 50% of my student workload because I was dedicated to getting in. But the way that you're able to take different samplings and work out what you want to do with your life is great. I think it's when you're 18, 19 years old, it's too early to, I mean, some people know from when they're going to be little kids what they want to do with their lives, but I think it's really important to have a chance to actively sample like that. And I would even encourage students to go to be proactive and actually reach out to people who do those jobs in the real world and find out what's really involved as well.
So from there, where did you go after Otago? What did you do?
Yeah, so around about the time that we graduated, the Al Gore movie, An Inconvenient Truth, came out.
Right.
And so Al just got us at exactly the right moment. And actually, I was at COP in Dubai just late last year. And actually a lot of people there that were saying the same thing happened to them. So that set us off on the path of working on climate change, both my wife and I. And so I had a law degree and a Chinese degree in my pocket. And it seemed to me that the logical thing to do, and you know, this is a very new graduate, a bit naive approach was like, okay, so China was on its path to being the greatest emitter in the world. And I thought, well, maybe I can be useful. Let's go see if I can be useful in some way to working on climate change. Now, back then, there just were very, very few jobs at all in working on climate, especially if you weren't already a seasoned diplomat or something like that, let alone a fresh graduate. So my wife actually had studied environmental policy specifically and did manage to land an unpaid internship in China with the U.S. Natural Resources Defense Council. But in my sake, I struggled to find something. But then serendipitously at the Kiwi Drinks one evening, I met an Otago alum called Luke Minford, who was running at the time the largest kind of international IP practice in China for a firm called Rouse. And he invited me to come in for a chat. And lo and behold, I landed a job and ended up being an intellectual property lawyer for the next 5 years. So a bit of a segue. Managed to pay off my student loan and pay for our wedding and support us while Claire actually worked her way up through a lot of unpaid and underpaid, heavily underpaid jobs to the point where she was able to actually go do a master's degree, and we moved to London for that while I supported us. And basically, once she was able to get a paying job, a properly paying job following her master's, we kind of switched over, and then I started working on climate. That wasn't necessarily exactly the game plan from day one, but it became a strategy and actually worked out pretty well.
So you had been in Beijing initially, had you, and then you moved to London?
That's right. Yeah. So I spent 5 years in Beijing. And while I was in Beijing, I was working in intellectual property, so getting quite a decent level of exposure to the manufacturing landscape in China as part of that experience. So through both anti-counterfeiting work and trademarks and patents for international clients that were themselves manufacturing in China or just trying to stop counterfeits coming out of China. And it was a fascinating time in China. The law was really evolving. It had gone from a system where basically fakes would get seized and destroyed, but nothing would really happen, through to a pretty internationally highly evolved legal system. And so being able to use more conventional legal means with increasing sophistication. But as part of that, I really saw how electric vehicles were at one point. So in 2009, Tesla launched the Roadster, right? So for those of us old enough to remember, before 2009, electric cars were and hybrids were, it was like the Prius One from Toyota, and they weren't, shall we say, as sexy and compelling as an electrified Lotus sports car, which George Clooney was driving around. So all of a sudden, electric was suddenly started to become very sexy. But actually, in China at that time already, there were around 200 million electric scooters and e-bikes on the road. So that got me thinking that, okay, maybe this e-mobility thing, which is obviously super necessary for shifting away from conventional internal combustion engines, which contribute about a third of global emissions, that needed to happen. But if we're all going to wait throughout the whole world and for this sort of trickle down from George Clooney's Roadster, $200,000 Roadster, to full mass market electrification across the board in every part of the world, we're going to be waiting a really long time. So around this time, I was looking at, well, maybe if we go shopping for, rather than follow the traditional automotive, which is actually you start with sports cars and then what you learn from that and you take certain technologies and then you apply them to luxury vehicles and then to premium vehicles, then eventually they end up in your Corolla or your mass market equivalent vehicle. Rather than follow that path, let's go looking for where are the unit economics the most compelling with existing technology already? Where can we find enough people that are spending enough money on fuel every day, driving a lot of miles every day, so hence again consuming a lot of fuel, where fuel itself per liter is expensive enough and where the net take home for those users is very high, that you've got this kind of magic combination of a large enough and it's what we call a total addressable market. So large enough people, enough billions of dollars being spent every year on fuel with enough density that we can serve them viably with a charge network and where that saving is really meaningful. So saving George Clooney $750 a year, but for a motorcycle taxi driver in Kigali or Nairobi or Dakar or Abu done, it's life changing. It actually doubles the take home income for most of our customers. And so we're able to go straight to this mass market rather than follow this trickle down kind of process, if you will. We're able to go straight to a mass market, and that mass market and the volumes that it generates in turn actually benefits then other markets. So in many ways, this market here in East Africa of all places is actually the thin end of the wedge for a much larger force globally.
Did it feel like a big leap to think, right, we're going to go to Africa and I'm going to start up this energy e-mobility startup? Or were you quite confident that it would work?
You know, I think there's a degree of maybe naive confidence. I read a book once where they talked about how Iceland generates a disproportionate number of kind of music, like really good music stars, you know, bands like Monsters and Men and so on. And I think it's a little bit that the isolation and the smallness. I think that we have a bit of that in New Zealand as well, where we have a certain amount of that kind of, you know, that bit of that pioneer gung-ho mentality, sort of get it done. You see a problem and you just sort of dive in and try to fix it. So I definitely think there's a bit of that naivete about it. I mean, there's certainly, you know, easier ways to build a business and make money out there in the world.
Was it hard when you decided to move? You know, what were your challenges?
I think it was pretty exciting. I think it wasn't that difficult to move. I had been to Africa before, actually through Claire's cousin, who had worked in Tanzania for quite a long time. So it wasn't completely unfamiliar territory. And I had done a trip scoping and looking at which country would be the best place to start. And there was already an entrepreneurial community in the region as well that had driven things like solar home systems where you can use a mobile phone, not unlike that old Nokia 3220. To make payments, to do banking, including activating and using solar power systems at home, but not connected to the grid at all. And so in some senses, was riding on the coattails of that. I think the key challenge that we've encountered along the way is that Africa simply doesn't get its sort of fair share of venture capital funding. It tends to, you know, most of the money stays in places that are safe. And so raising the right sort of capital to actually build up a business like ours, you know, we're an electric vehicle company. We've done phenomenal things with the money that we have raised relative to much, much larger companies that still are performing, you know, financially much, I'd say, not as well, but that's being also driven by scarcity, and I think there's still you know, Africa's not viewed as the same level of opportunity now. Even though continent's going to have about 2.5 billion people by 2050 out of 9 billion people, and there are certainly success stories here.
So where is Ampersand now? How many people are you employing? How many e-motorcycles are you providing? Where is the company now? After that's what, almost 10 years, isn't it?
Yeah, so I started doing the initial scoping for it. Yeah, about 10 years ago. Back then, it was just me and a laptop. So we've grown now. It took quite a long time. You know, electric vehicles are not simple things. But we sold our first motorbike in May of 2019. We raised our first institutional capital a couple of years before that in 2017. We've gone through a Series A and now are recently in an intermediate round between a Series A and a Series B, which was around $21 million USD. We've got 400 staff. We've just passed 400 staff. We have 2,200 active users right now. We should be able to hit something around 6,500, 7,000 by the end of the year with the capital that we've already raised. But if we're able to raise additional capital this year, we pass that as well. So the motorbikes currently cover around 1.5 million kilometers every day, even at that number of even at that relatively modest volume relative to the 30 million or so motorbikes that are operating across the continent, and we're also able to deliver really healthy cost savings. So 35% cost reduction for customers, but the motorbikes themselves cost about the same because we use a battery swapping system, so that separates the upfront cost of the battery from the motorcycle itself. So customers are able to get a motorbike that actually has more power than a conventional petrol bike, that actually costs less to both acquire and finance and operate, and delivers the 35% cost saving back into the user's pocket.
So as well as the climate benefits in terms of emissions, you're also looking at the wider societal benefit to the people that use your bikes and the cost that it's taking them.
Yeah, I mean, that was clear from day one. You know, I think the adoption of electric vehicles in even Western countries, you know, where people do have more disposable income, people still tend to put their pockets first unless they're eco warriors, at least for most of the past few decades, right? And so, you know, these guys, and it is mostly guys, but also women who we serve, they tend to, they're about the last people in the world that I should be coming, you know, that we can come in, especially as foreigners, and harp on about climate change and what they need to do. I mean, we all need to pull together, and our customers actually have a really, a kind of humbling level of dedication to the overall mission and climate change to our surprise. But really, it was clear from day one, we just had to offer a vehicle that was simply cheaper and better from the get-go. And just, you know, the fact that it was electric was, you know, oh, that's interesting, or, you know, a nice to have. And so that's what we set out to do, and that's what we've done.
So are you going to stay where you are at the moment, or have you got plans for the future to expand any further or different products?
Yeah, it's at the moment, it's, you know, the global venture capital ecosystem, you know, in tandem with the general health of the global economy, it's pretty low. So the emphasis at the moment is to reach profitability. We already have really healthy gross margins in addition to saving our customers a lot of money. So we're pushing towards profitability pretty soon. But that means that we tend to focus on the countries where we already operate and reaching higher volumes, and so better unit economics, better economies of scale in the places where we already are. And then once we pass profitability, looking at further expansion. But generally, we're looking at the core focus for us is a string of countries, about making up about half of the total motorbike fleet on the continent, running between Dar es Salaam, so on the east coast in the equatorial belt, through to the west coast in Dakar. So kind of and then more globally, if you look at the equatorial belt between the tropics of Capricorn and Cancer, that's where you find most motorbikes being used, particularly in developing countries, and being used as these commercial vehicles. So for deliveries and taxis, that's where you get the best unit economics. And it also accounts for the most air pollution and the most carbon emissions across the globe from light vehicles, including also three-wheelers as well, so tuk-tuks in the India, Southeast Asia, and to some extent in Africa as well.
So Josh, when you're not working, what are you doing? What's life like there?
Yeah, so we have a son who's 2.5. So when I'm not working, I tend to enjoy spending time with him. Luke is a lot of fun right now. And then when I can, we'll go out motorbiking and exploring Kenya as well. So there's a beautiful coastline here with a lot of historic cities and, you know, tropical beaches, but also the wildlife is world famous around here as well. So we try to get out and enjoy that too.
And is Claire part of Ampersand, or is she working in a different area?
No, Claire's been a champion at different times, but it's definitely healthier, I think, to maintain a degree of separation. So Claire has also been working on climate change. So in Kigali, she was the energy and then later also climate coordinator. Once it was with the Biden administration, it was okay to talk about climate change again. So it became the climate coordinator there in Rwanda for their activities. And we've recently, with the move over to Kenya, she's been working for USAID's global climate team based here as well.
So just circling back, is there anything that you would have done differently in terms of your time at Otago? Has your degree served you well? And have you got anything you'd like to tell students today when they're thinking about their future? Because I can't imagine sitting in a law lecture that you might have thought you were going to be working in e-bikes in Kenya.
Yeah, I mean, yes, certainly, I think that's true. I think in hindsight, I wish now, going back and doing the work that I'm doing, that, you know, I had taken more business courses. I think the would have been a bit easier. You know, I didn't go off and do an MBA before starting the company. Didn't have the money to do that. So I think that would have been useful. I think it was, you know, certainly great that I took a wide variety of courses. I certainly don't regret doing a law degree, and I enjoyed very much working in the law for many years, and I enjoyed the intellectual rigor of it. And I still find the kind of analytical process very useful. I'd say sometimes I'm in my business and I've been too detail oriented, but other times it's served me very, very well, not prematurely jumping into something and burning all the cash, and being able to actually input into the design and legal processes for countries to actually craft legislation to make that real and align that with our key drivers as a business, you know, aligning with what matters in actually accelerating this transition, has, you know, the law has certainly come in useful there.
Well, you've certainly circled right round Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth. I think he'd be happy with the impression that he made.
I hope so.
It's been very successful for you. Yeah.
I'm not sure if he listens to this podcast, but if you're listening, Al, thank you very much.
I will send him an invitation. Oh, that's great. Thanks, Josh. Thanks so much. It's really interesting to hear what you're doing. And I, you know, hope it all goes well in the future.
Thank you. It's been a real real honor and a pleasure to circle back and reminisce about my Otago days.
This podcast is part of a University of Otago alumni series presented by Margie Clark and produced by Fiona McDonald from the Development and Alumni Office of the University of Otago.